We've been fighting a long time, and we have all lost so very much, so many loved ones gone. But you are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. You have no idea how important you are. If you're listening to this, you are the resistance.
Ave Maria.
Welcome, everybody, back for another book review. Steve with Science Fidelity. I'm coming with you, Alex Torres. I think I said that right. I know I should have asked you before I clicked go, but anyway, he wrote a book co-authored with Joshua Charles, Persecuted from Within, which kind of a good topic for these days. Alex, how you doing? Thanks for coming on.
I'm doing all right. And yeah, I should have corrected you maybe. It's Alec with a C, but that's okay. My mom used to cycle through every single one of my brother's names before she got to mine when I was growing up. So I'm used to getting called the wrong thing.
I know, but
I'm doing all right. I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you so much for letting me talk about the book here.
Well, thanks for saying yes. Thanks for writing the book. But now when you said that, I thought about my grandma. She would go through the whole litany of all the names and then even the dog. Scruffy, who are you?
And it's just like, you go do this. Yeah, yes. Exactly.
And I'm getting that way now. So anyway, what made you and Josh talk about this? There's not a page, I don't get to say this very often, I think, that wasn't informative, or I mean the concluding chapter, it was like, in conclusion, here's 20 pages, which I was like, wow, that's a long concluding chapter, but it was great from the intro all the way in. First, what made you guys decide to do that? Obviously, I feel like that's a softball question, but in case it isn't.
No, it was I mean, it really was a bit of a Holy Spirit intervention here, because I'm a ghostwriter by training. You know, I was a speechwriter for President Trump and Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Josh was a speechwriter at the White House as well. So we get out of the White House, we're writing, I'm ghostwriting my whole life. Huh. And it hits me one day. I'm like, you know, there is just a lot of confusion in the church. That didn't hit me one day. That I've known for a while. But yeah, I'm looking around myself, I'm thinking, how do I deal with all this? I mean, I want to be a good Catholic. I'm a convert. I know there's a lot of things I don't know. How do I deal with all this? How do I, if a bishop or a cardinal or heck, even a pope says something that's just confusing as heck or even wrong, do I have to follow that? Do I have to not? When can I say no? When do I say yes? What is obedience like? I didn't know the answer. So the thought hit me, why don't I ask the people who probably do know the answer? And that's the saints. So it just hit me one day. That's not a bad book idea. So I presented it to a friend of mine and he said, you should talk to Josh about this. So I talked to him and thankfully he helped me out, working out who to choose and how to build out the book and to even just to write it, because my goodness, this was a hefty lift. You know, we're writing mini biographies of 12 different saints or saints to be. So it was a big project.
And I was just thinking a different title, Ghosts, right? Ghost written by ghosts or something like that. I mean, two ghostwriters coming.
Yeah. Well, it tells you how much we care about it, though. I mean, I was fine not writing it at all. I wanted to shove it off to other people. And I said, please, somebody should write this because I would love to read it. I want to know. I generally don't know the answer. So I kept, and it's like, I don't have the time. I'm like, well, I know how to write. I mean, my goodness, it's what the Lord made me do. So I figured if somebody had to do it, it might as well be me. If I was trying to push it on other people, I had to take it on myself. And I figured I don't have the authority to comment on a lot of Catholic things, but I can look at history and I can tell you what it says. So I felt equipped to do that.
Yeah, so part of the intro that I had doggy marked or earmarked, whatever you want to call it, there's a couple lines. If we go into schism, we should expect our souls to meet the same fate. As faithful Catholics, we are neither schismatic nor Donatists, those who believe that the clergy must be without fault in order to be legitimate. We recognize our clergy will never be perfect and that their imperfections are never an excuse to break from the church. If our faith is shaken by bad Christians, then our faith is not in Christ, but in men. And again, this that was just on like, you know, a couple pages into the intro. It just keeps going from there.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, that is, in many ways, this wouldn't be a big subject if you were in any other church, right? Because no other church but the Catholic Church makes such a big claim about what the nature of the church is. You know, if a Protestant has a preacher or a pastor who's saying crazy things, they're like, okay, whatever. If he has the wrong interpretation, I'm going to go to a church that I think has the right interpretation. But Catholics, you know, we really do believe that the church is what Jesus said it is. Yeah. And that it's the unblemished bride of Christ. So how do you square that? You know, we have priests who are bad. There have been bad priests from the beginning, but we believe the church is the spotless bride of Christ. Okay, let's work out how that can actually be the case in the real world practically. And Jesus showed us that right from the beginning. That's why we quoted or when it went into that there in the intro about having our faith in Christ, not men, because ultimately we have to trust his words and what he says about the church.
Yeah, there's a Frank Sheed line that I don't know if you heard the sermon, Christ is the Point. He goes into that. He goes, we're not going into the beatific vision of the Pope. We're not going into the communion of the cardinals. And he mentions that Frank Sheed's talking about, I think, was it Paul VI? Even if I don't wish he was Catholic, I'm not leaving. I might not like him, but he's, you know, where's the reference? Which gets into all the saints in here. I go, you know what common thing of all these, and here's all the pages of it, is I did not read one time when they went, nah, I'm going to do it my own way, or, you know, the heck with you, I'm going to do it. It's kind of like we're in not to use Americanism, but that don't tread on me-ism nowadays. These guys didn't have that. It was more, we're going to submit to the Alphonsus line, which that might trigger a lot of people. Instead of, you know, I'm going to do it my way, these guys submitted to even getting abused by Holy Mother Church like Pio.
Yeah, it is shocking what they dealt with. I mean, it's one thing to read history, but when I sat with it for a really long time, I thought, how in the world would I actually, myself, with all of my sins and all my concupiscences, how would I deal with what these saints dealt with? And Padre Pio was a great example there. I mean, he was essentially put in what he called an imprisonment. He was not allowed to hear confessions. He was not allowed to celebrate the mass publicly. At one point, they even told him, his superiors told him that if he passed people in the hallway, he could nod at them in acknowledgement, but he couldn't speak to them. I mean, what a ridiculous limitation on somebody's liberty. And to believe that anybody has the right to do that too. But with Padre Pio, he did swear obedience. So he said, yes, I will. And I think there's hard lessons for Catholics all across the spectrum here, because that's one of them is, it kind of doesn't matter how bad it may get for you personally or how unjust the situation may be for you personally. The church really does preach in her doctrine and in the lives of her saints, submit, obey, obey, obey. And that is the hardest way that we can mortify our will and come closer to Christ. But it's there. It's everywhere. We have to.
Yeah, that's the last couple pages is what obedience is, true obedience and false obedience. And like I said, you bring in the line of Alphonsus, the will of the Pope is the will of God. I mean, people are probably going to, like I said, get triggered on that. Not saying that, you know, what you're thinking, what people are probably thinking right now. Explain that situation for the listeners, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, Alphonsus Liguori, all these saints are wonderful. It's kind of hard to say, like, oh, what a wonderful saint. they're kind of all great.
Yeah, but like,
my goodness, like his order was just being crushed, and you know, the Pope was restricting it. For a lot of it was honestly his own fault, and some missteps were there. I won't reveal too much of the story, but it's some pretty illuminating back and forth about how to manage things practically in the world. But when he did face restrictions, when his order was being suppressed, that's when he said that line, the will of the Pope is the will of God. But you have to understand that in its context. I mean, he was referring to how the Pope was managing his order, something that is absolutely within the Pope's jurisdiction and that is within his competency as the head of the church, as the vicar of Christ, rather. I mean, obviously Christ is the head of the church, but he's his vicar on earth. So he could say that. Now, he did not say the Pope's will is God's will, right? If he did that, then he'd be saying that God is submitted to man, and that's never the case. So if the Pope, in a way, Alphonsus Liguori couldn't he never, I don't want to say wouldn't have thought of it, but it just wasn't a factor in his time or in his life that the Pope would either would ever command something contrary to the will of God. And if that were the case, if St. Alphonsus the Great is a saint, as we believe he is, he couldn't say, oh, of course, yes, follow the Pope when he contradicts God. No. Our obedience is always hierarchical. It's a, I mean, there's quotes in there from St. Augustine. If you follow your prelate, if you'd follow, and if the, you know, if your governor commands something, but the emperor says something above him, you follow the emperor, not the governor. How much more for God? God's at the top. So we have to follow him above everything else.
And you got to start off, you go right from the beginning with the apostles and all through. I mean, Bruno's a great one. I mean, there was a, I do a lot of the conferences, not that I speak at, I go to them, voluntarily pay the table to give away stuff. And I remember a couple years ago, somebody came up just losing her mind. And you know how bad the Pope is today, how bad the church is today. I go, well, have you heard of the Cadaver Synod? And she looked at me like, you know, what did I just say? Well, did you just cuss at me? What did you say? And explained to her the whole situation. And she goes, I never heard that before. Her husband comes up, goes, thank you for that. I calmed her down. Go, almost the line of, you know, was it Newman? Ignorance of history is to be deep in history is to cease being Protestant. Mm-hmm. Could not that be said to be deep in history is to cease being anxious? I mean, Bruno's time, the pornocracy.
Oh, it was. I mean, it was legitimately terrible. It's one of those paradoxes of the faith, right? That I tell people, oh, well, I wrote a book. It's about a bunch of saints who were persecuted and completely abused by hierarchs within the church, by their own superiors. They suffered gravely for it. And it's really hopeful. And people kind of look at me like, are you like insane? Is something wrong in your head? But there is hope in it in that, one, I mean, they all are saints. So they achieved the goal, the purpose of our lives. They made it through their own times. But you also see their times were confusing as heck. Their times were wild. I mean, I love bringing up Bruno because a lot of times people don't know about his situation. There was invading armies coming into Rome and out of Rome, revolts from the Romans themselves. The Pope is fleeing. The Pope is coming back. The Pope is under duress. The Pope is captured by an emperor who's forced, and he's forced to sign things he would never sign if he wasn't, you know, locked away in prison. You know, there's prostitutes who are running the Vatican. I mean, it's the moral, doctrinal, and just practical confusion of that time is terrifying. I think it was six cardinals or something who elected the real Pope at that point, as opposed to the anti-Pope. How in the world is a lay Catholic are you supposed to know what's going on? But that's kind of the point. We aren't actually required to know all the nitty-gritty details. I mean, it's not bad to know church, the news of the Vatican and what's going on and what's happening in the Synod and Synodality and what happened with the Dubia and what happened. It's fine. It's all good. But our job is to be holy in our own lives, to follow true Catholic teaching, to educate ourselves and our children and to commune with God. So if we're doing that, it's okay if we kind of don't read the political scene or the news from the Vatican perfectly, or we don't have the right judgment on every single little case that comes in front of us.
I just think of 24/7 internet, 24/7 news media picking up Jenna Jameson elected the Pope, that, or you know, whatever the porn the names of the day are. Yeah. Could you imagine that with social media, things like that? And that's not even getting into digging up a dead Pope, cutting his fingers off, taking away all those falconies, and then the back and forth that happened years later when restoring, taking away, restoring, taking away.
Like you said, so much of the scandal is because we can know so much right now. I mean, sin has always been there and evil people have always been there. Now we just know about it, right? Because the internet brings it right to our face. Though I would caution in some ways that our time is unique in many ways, right? It's a weird thing to say, but it's almost more comforting to be like, okay, there's weird people doing some very sinful, bad things over there, as opposed to what if a person in authority is strategically ambiguous or even outright incorrect on doctrine. That is a little bit more unique in history and something that we have to negotiate and face in our own times. So I think we have to walk into it not being puffed up thinking, oh, our times, woe am I, our times are so bad. No, it's been terrible before, but we do have a unique situation that we have to deal with and learn how to face.
Yeah, like you said, I mean, all this stuff going on, that's still, when come judgment day, that's, you're not going to get that excuse before the Supreme Judge. Oh, well, yeah, this was going on. That, I can see why you kind of fell away. No, that's ownership. You could be completely ignorant of what's going on in Rome, but if you're becoming holier and holier and studying the faith and prayer life and things like that, it's not, it shouldn't bother you.
No, it really, I mean, it just brings,
it bothers you to a point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes, we should be right. Only God is infinite. So only God can manage all these things. Only God can care about all these things. So we have to pick and choose our battles here. You know, as a father, as a lay Catholic, you know, I'm a writer. So I have a platform here in a way to be able to aid in these situations. But for example, for myself, I don't engage in social media. I'm not on there at all. You know, I think I have an account just to check up on things because they block me out if I don't, but I don't tweet anything. I don't post anything. I'm not on TikTok. I'm not on Instagram because that's not my spot. I know that if I wasn't guarding myself, would probably just shoot from the hip and start saying stupid things and get myself into trouble. And that's not my job. My job is to be holy and is to raise my children in the faith, right? Lead my family. So if I just focus on that, the news from the Vatican, the news from the church, the news from bishops can come in and out. And it's distressing, especially when I'm talking to non-Catholics or Catholics who are wavering in their faith. But you want to be that solid rock that they can look to then to know that the church has some crazy people in it, but it's true and it works because it's working for you.
Was that the line of, was it Napoleon when or one of his generals goes up to the cardinal and says, we're going to destroy your church. Go for it. We've been trying for 1700 years.
We couldn't do it for 1800 years and you're not going to succeed.
Well, it's not a running joke, but there was a conversion story? It's a conversion of a Jewish businessman.
I think it was Boccaccio, if I remember correctly.
The one when he goes, let's go get baptized, thing. And the priest is like, no, let's get baptized now before you go to Rome.
Yeah, I think that was it. He goes off to Rome anyway, and he just sees how terrible it is.
Yeah.
You know, oh my gosh, there were poor people in the street and wealthy bishops walking right by him and people with their mistresses and, you know, churchmen doing this and that. So yeah, I want to get baptized. Wait, what? You want to get baptized? After seeing all of that, he says, yeah, any church that's run by people like that and is still around has to be true.
Talk about great apologetic work right there, just for that. What was the story that you researched that you went wow over? What was like your top wow story?
Oh gosh. You know, I almost got to open up my table of contents here to look back at it. Because part of it was, you know, as a co-author work, thank God it was, because this was a lot to, it was a lot to fight off for one person. So I kind of came in and out of it with certain of the saints. You know, we edited everything. In many ways, I don't know if this is the one, but it really was astounding. I knew about St. Athanasius, right, in the Arian crisis. And I'd heard how bad it was, but I don't think I really quite grappled with it until I saw the history. I mean, this was a time, you know, we don't need to go all into Arianism. Suffice to say that it was teaching incorrect doctrine about Christ. You know, and if you have indirect doctrine about Christ, everything else falls apart too. Salvation falls apart. You know, the whole point of the Catholic Church falls apart. So this was a massive heresy, and it really was that the majority of the visible church was Arian, objectively heretical, against the council of the church, against the teachings of the church, and relatively early in the church history too. This isn't like the 300s. And it was the point, it was to the point where there was, I mean, St. Athanasius was by far the most renowned of the dissenters here, but there were very few with him, exiled 6 times, and he was telling people, you know, lay Catholics, if you see a church, you go into a church and the priest there is a heretic and he's preaching heresy, you should not go to that church. You should not go to their mass because it is detrimental to your faith. You will risk your faith, which is more important than he didn't say it this way, but essentially more important than fulfilling your Sunday obligation, because you're really not fulfilling your Sunday obligation if you're in that sort of compromised situation. That's how bad it was, that individual Catholics had to decide based upon their formation and rooted in the teachings of the church, which weren't as ingrained at that time, how to deal with it on an actual personal basis, facing widespread heresy. If you lived at that time, I mean, you really would have thought that the church was over at that point, or that the church as an institution would go on, but it could just change its doctrines however it felt, depending on, you know, the tides of time, mm-hmm. Which is as much as saying the church isn't true. Wild, wild history.
Yeah, I think even, was it Newman that wrote the book on Arians that they even talked about the dragging Catholics in the street and killing them?
Yeah, it's brutal. We this was one of the difficulties with the book. It's a decently sizable book. It's not crazy that you can't read, but we had to curb ourselves from adding in too much material as Padre Pio is an example, we almost get into none of his miracles, bilocations, levitation, stuff like that. You just don't have the time. It's amazing stuff. You know, getting into Newman on Arian would have been wonderful to do, but at a certain point, we're like, every single one of these saints could have a multi-volume biography, and we got to give them a chapter.
Yeah. If you were going to do that, each one would be a volume each.
I'd be writing it, you know, by the time we'd finish it, you know, maybe the second coming would have happened. Who knows?
So just in case y'all don't know, the chapters were Christ, so he brings the King of Betrayed Saints, St. Paul, St. Athanasius, St. Bruno, St. Joan of Arc, St. John Fisher and Thomas More, John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, Alphonsus, St. Mary McAuliffe of Australia, St. Padre Pio, and Venerable Fulton Sheen at the end. So for everyone that was wanting to get into the more modern times, you had Pio and Sheen.
Yeah, we wanted that full stretch, you know, Christ and St. Paul all the way up to the 20th century, covering, you know, North Africa, Europe, the Americas. We were just spreading everywhere. You know, we really wanted it to be Catholic, right?
Yes, that's for sure. Yes. Yeah, you didn't get South Africa. I mean, I guess you could.
Right, we got Oceania at least. You know, we missed South Africa down there. Sub-Saharan Africa, we didn't quite get to yet. But sadly, there's a lot of really wonderful people who have been persecuted by the church. So, you know,
yeah, there's a long list we could have chosen. You only got 11 or 10, I guess, regular Joes in here. But it wasn't like those are the only 10. I mean, that was probably, God, Christ did say, take up your cross, not take up your lazy boy and get comfy and get a big gulp to go with it.
Yeah, it was there are innumerable in many ways. We thought these were pretty demonstrative and had different lessons for us. And then you have to think about how many suffered, how many in the Arian crisis suffered who don't have a formal, you know, saint blank next to their name because they were unknown, like so many of us will be. We just got to take the big exemplars that we can and sort of be guided by their experience, in large part because we have so much historical material from them too.
I like that you brought up Joan of Arc as the new Deborah.
Yeah, it was. I got to give credit where credit's due. That was my co-author who pulled that up and weaved it together. I really did think it was accurate. He's very good at exegesis and is extremely well read on these matters. Unlike me, actually, Josh Charles has an online presence and you can find him on Twitter. He's very worth following.
A ghostwriter for Josh right now.
Yeah, right. That one was a very rigorous chapter because unlike so many books about Joan of Arc, it really got into the primary source material about the trial that she endured back and forth and back and forth with as it was recorded at the time. It was pretty difficult to pull off. It's kind of hard to find such things in English and then get the rights and everything like that. But I think it was really well worth it because people can see exactly what she faced and the lines that were being drawn there. But yeah, she had to call the church to task and just by her example.
Which chapter did you work mostly on? Which ones were yours more primary?
Well, there's some that there's some that I really did take the lead pen on, some that were a good mixture between us, and then some that were more him. So most of them are probably in that mixed category. But I sort of was driving the bus, I would say, on Padre Pio, Venerable Fulton Sheen, and St. Paul, and then Maybe I really kicked it off, I think, with the intro and the conclusion, but it became a really big collaborative work there too at the end. He saw a lot of my blind spots or a lot of extra material that I wasn't aware of to make it as full and complete.
So you were the sandwich bread. He got the meat in the middle. You got the bread on
the
side.
Yeah, exactly. Which kind of makes sense, right? The idea flashed into my head. So you know, I kind of had a vision for the beginning. And then I had a vision for the end, and I'm like, oh, what's everything in the middle? And then Josh, the historian, comes in and says, I can handle a lot of good stuff here. Don't worry.
So you worked on the Sheen one a little bit. So tell, in case people don't know that Sheen had persecution in there, how did he handle it? And I mean, there was a great line that you had in there about the Pius the 12th telling him about asking him how many he converted. He goes, I don't know, because it wouldn't. I don't keep up with that because I would think it was me.
Yeah. If I counted, I'd start thinking it was me making the conversions and not God. Surprised me in a way. I wasn't actually aware of his persecution too much because, you know, so much of it focuses on him in popular culture on TV and his programs on radio. But his persecution, I think, is a worthwhile one to look at because in many ways it was so inane. It was rooted. The basis of it is actually milk money, if you can believe it. There was a program. Long story short, Sheen is running a massive charity program through the church, and his cardinal Spellman gives him milk to donate to the poor. Okay, easy. This happens all the time. Cardinal Spellman himself had been given that milk from the U.S. government. This is the post-war period. Europe's in shambles. You know. It's a tough time for a lot of the world. So Spellman says, okay, Sheen, you got to pay me for the milk. And Sheen goes, I don't need to pay you for the milk. You got it for free from the government. So it was such a stupid dispute in many ways, but Sheen was in the right. And it went all the way up to the Vatican. It went all the way to the Pope because it had to do with a cardinal and one of his bishops. You know, there's really no other arbiter there. So you have to imagine the Pope in this situation too. Like, really, you guys are sitting in my office and I have to tell you who's right about who paid for the milk and you have the receipts. I mean, doesn't he have better things to do with his time?
He said, so, take it to the church.
Right. I mean, gosh, like, it's just pray for the Pope, pray for your Metropolitan, pray for your Bishop. We have no idea the number of stupid things that they have to deal with, you know, on top of the important ones. So long story short, the Pope's like, yeah, we got the receipts. Sheen, you're right about this. You don't have to pay for it. And Spellman was incensed, absolutely incensed that he was contradicted and then embarrassed in front of the Pope, even though it was of his own making. So he vowed revenge against Sheen. And it took about 10 years and he pulled it off. Sheen got removed from his charitable position, and he was running a very popular TV program. I mean, basic black chalkboard, Sheen in full regalia, writing and guiding people towards virtue, towards the Christian faith. And it had just millions of viewers. You know, he was on the cover of Time magazine and stuff. He got kicked off of that. And then he got sent from New York City, where he was thriving. I mean, just bell of the ball in that town, over to Rochester to be an actual managerial bishop there. You know, the actual bishop of Rochester, not just an auxiliary bishop within the Diocese of New York, New York City. And he floundered, absolutely floundered at it. I mean, this is later in his life. A man, he had like a golden touch. There's nothing he did that he failed at until he got to Rochester. I won't go too far into the details. I know I'm already talking about him so much, but let's just put it this way. Massive protests against him from people within the community. Priests signed an open letter. I think it was something like half of the priests in his diocese signed an open letter against him. And he was there for 2 years. I floundered at this. So gosh, you can face persecution over something as stupid as milk money. But that's what the Lord sometimes, it's almost nicer if it's like, I'm dying for the faith. You know, I'm Joan of Arc and I have visions and I'm not going to betray what the visions have told me from the Lord, as opposed to being like, well, I don't want to lie about the milk money.
Yeah, I mean, there's persecutions from the church, persecutions from your own order, your brother bishops. And then you got the lady going after you. I mean, Teresa and John had their own orders go after them. Alphonsus had his own order go after him. You brought up at the end the letter that St. Mary MacKillop, her mom wrote.
Yeah.
What she said to her mom after.
Yeah, it's a beautiful scene here because Mary MacKillop, there's a couple saints in there that people aren't as familiar with, myself included, before I worked on the book, and Mary MacKillop was one of them. And, I mean, she is one of the few saints who has ever been excommunicated. You know, it tells you how grave the situation was. The details of her excommunication and the back and forth there and the miscommunications and everything, you know, people should read it. It's quite fascinating how it all played out. But the point is ultimately that she was 100% in the right. Her bishop who excommunicated her was in the wrong. And she, in that period of unknown, I mean, I don't care how holy you are. I don't care how much you think you're in the right. If your bishop says you are excommunicated, that has to send a little bit of a shiver down any faithful Catholic spine. Like, you don't want to be on the wrong side of this. Even if you have faith that you're right and that you'll be justified in the end, you know, that's just a lot of doubt to hold on to. Mm-hmm. So she's in that situation, and her mother writes this letter to be posted in the paper saying, I regret that my daughter ever vowed obedience to you. I regret that she would ever put herself, I guess she didn't technically vow obedience, but ever put herself under your authority, Mr. Bishop. And Mary said, my mother is completely right. My mother vindicated me, but oh, at what a cost. Mm-hmm. Because she attacked the bishop publicly. And it wasn't attacking that. It wasn't saying the bishop said something wrong and is leading souls astray. It wasn't saying the bishop was, God forbid, abusive to minors and we have to hold him to account for that. It wasn't anything like that. It was a personal thing against St. Mary MacKillop that she knew she had to just bear it. And her mother lashed out and she felt like that was the absolute wrong thing to do while being 100% in the right.
Yeah, he was a... The line she said, if we cannot speak well of their acts, talking about the bishops, let us be silent.
Mm-hmm.
Even like you brought Pio too, was I guess a friend of his wanted to blackmail Rome to get Pio's
Brunato.
Huh?
Yeah, it was Brunato. He was a wild figure in Padre Pio's life, just kind of a bomb thrower.
Can't imagine, you know, Italians being that way.
Yeah, but he wanted to just put in every scandal on the book, everything bad in the Vatican, as a way to blackmail the Vatican into releasing Padre Pio from all of his restrictions. And Padre Pio said, you will have no part with me if you do this. You do not put my name on this. You are no son of the church. If you are blackmailing, if you're using Satan's methods mm-hmm. to try and accomplish God's work, you are not on my team. You're on Satan's team and you better stop it.
Yeah, the line is blush for shame and tremble with fear.
Yeah, yeah. This is why it was so helpful, I think, to look at so many saints, mm-hmm. because so many times people will look at a particular one and try to draw a single rule out of that. So they look at Padre Pio, for example, and they say Padre Pio was silent and he submitted even against injustice and all these bad things. And when somebody was trying to air the church's dirty laundry to expose scandal, Padre Pio said no. Well, you'd look at that and you'd say, what's the lesson? We just take it on the chin. You obey, you don't complain, you be silent, and you don't talk about scandals in the church. Well, that was a particular circumstance. And for the most part, I would say as a rule, Catholics should obey. You know, if you are uncertain, choose obedience. If it's just something that's hitting you, choose obedience. But then we see other saints, St. Paul, St. Athanasius, John Fisher, who contradicted those in authority, even those who had greater authority than them in some circumstances, for the sake of the faith. So we have to know what fight we're having here before we draw pure and direct rules.
Yeah, it's kind of, you were saying that, made me think of, you know, a couple of years ago, they were forcing people to wear... First time many priests talked about the clothing in their lives, about something go over your mouth. And we were joking, saying now if the bishop says to wear a pink bunny outfit, he don't have the authority to do that. But if he takes away faculties, you just can't go, nah, I got him. Two different things. Just,
yeah.
Like you said, it's not a blanket thing. You got to figure out what is talking. Like John Fisher, you mentioned, yeah, he stood against the marriage. But if it was something else, he may not have been sort of like, all right, you know, it's the context of each situation.
Yeah, and there are, you know, it's not as if everything is circumstantial. There are principles there, and I mean, it's too much. You kind of gotta, I hate to say it, but you kind of gotta read it to understand it, because it's too much to just get out in one interview. And we try to lay those out in the conclusion, looking at them and trying to see the unity underneath certain seeming contradictions. But you're right. I mean, ultimately there are rules to follow and certain ways to classify events to determine how we should act. I mean, the last chapter that goes through all of this, I can't even claim that I'm some brilliant person who figured this out. All I did was restate Thomas Aquinas and try to update it for people to understand it in the circumstances that we're existing in now and based on the saints that we looked at. So there is a lot of clarity to be had, even in circumstances that can seem contradictory.
And there's many times measured in my own life. Just to have you read the lives of the saints when they complain. I can't remember. There's like four or five different stories of it. And Christ from the cross appears to them and go, and what did I do to get my position up here? And you think, well, he remained silent. He took the abuse. He let himself get crucified.
Yeah.
And when he was innocent, and he didn't complain. He didn't talk smack from the cross or anything like that. Which, if you like the, you meant, we talked about St. Mary and, you know, Pio, you could think, compared to modern ones, there are some Carmelites that went out and just went, to their bishop, which, and you have some priests out there making
cash. Actually, right down the street from my in-law's house is where that monastery is. So that one hit close to home. I almost wanted to, I didn't want to be like passive aggressive here, but I almost wanted to send everyone the books and be like, yeah, maybe just take a read here. You know, like some food for thought, a little bit of reflection, maybe.
Might not be a bad idea. But yeah, there's others that are making, almost making a name for themselves for being persecuted, and gaining donations and, just capitalizing in the situation, which you read it going, these guys didn't do anything like that.
Mm-hmm. It really was. I mean, they when you see the saints speaking out, you see them with righteous anger sometimes even, but never to defend themselves, never for the sake of their own aggrandizement, never even for the sake of justice to be done to themselves. Their willingness to accept abuse and injustice personally, it's not infinite ultimately because they were humans, but it was infinite through Christ. That's who they were imitating in those circumstances. So if you got to ask yourself, especially if you're online and you're tweeting about things or just, talking with friends about problems in the church, you better think long and hard if what you're trying to defend is your opinion, your sense of justice, what you would prefer to happen, or if it's the true doctrine of the church, the fundamental teachings. How are you going to lay yourself down in those situations? Because if it's about yourself at any point in time, that's where sin has crept in, and that's where the saints don't cross that line.
You're kind of getting into the P word. It sounds like pride. Oh, yeah, pride. No one likes to have their heart, they don't like being attacked. No one likes to be called out in front of others or silenced. So you get back and you're like, no, I'm going to, stand up. Here's the line. I'm going to fight for myself a little bit versus...
And even the way that saints respond too shows. So if you're obligated to respond in some way, the way you do it demonstrates whether pride has seeped in or not. I mean, the root of the dubia, which has been in the news as of late, is from St. Paul when Peter was, I mean, essentially he was refusing to eat with the Gentiles, implying that you had to follow Jewish law in order to be a Christian, right? That's a pretty scandalous thing. It's incorrect. He wasn't teaching things wrong, but by his actions, he was leading people astray. So St. Paul called him out on it. He did not say, Peter, you stupid idiot. Hey, Peter, you're wrong. I'm right. He posed Peter a question, a dubium, and confronted Peter with his error through his question, which is why there's a long tradition within the Catholic Church of doing that. Now, we formally, as a lay Catholic, I don't have any authority to pose a dubium to my bishop or to a cardinal or to the Pope or anything like that. But what it reveals is your approach to error within the church still have, even if you need to confront it, and there are times in which we need to confront it, still has to be done from an ultimate, ultimately from a position of humility.
Yeah, a lot of people bring that up in Catherine of Siena for, you know, calling out the Pope. I remember telling somebody, I said, until you start raising the dead like she was, maybe you should hold off on comparing yourself to Catherine.
Mm-hmm. It's I find it much more likely with Catholics in my position, you know, just looking at my own life, that our job isn't necessarily to go and just, you know, right in the Pope's face and tell him what's wrong. It's actually more to manage the after effects of scandal within our own circles, right? I have a lot of non-Catholic family members and friends, and they see something and they said, wait a second, I just saw what in the world was some pagan idol doing in the Vatican. That, you believe in this church? Like, are you a psycho? What's going on? Or, hey, is your church going to change its teachings about like who can be a priest? I didn't know that that was possible. And, you know, sometimes the news is not quite correct. Sometimes they are actually seeing what's right. But either way, sure, you can say what the Pope said here was wrong or what the Vatican did here was wrong or whatever it is. But it's actually our own individual. God places us within our families, our communities, our towns, our friend groups, to minister to them and to shepherd them in many ways, even if it's not our formal roles as, you know, pastors of the church. So we got to know our stuff for the sake of the souls nearest to us, and to just pull as many of them along as we can to get them into the church or to keep them in the church and to bring us to heaven.
That's a great point, because this is a great apologetic time too. I mean, I remember years ago someone asked, what do you think about Pope Francis? Say he's opening a lot of doors for conversations, which you can teach people what the faith, what the truth is, and things like that. So in a sense, you can use some bad stuff for good. Mm-hmm. Kind of like, you know, go back to Christ.
I even think that this is a situation that demonstrates, you know, Catholics, it's we're almost more comfortable to argue on points of history or doctrine, you know, and to sort of win debates like that, or to just show, you know, to point to great holy figures in our history, or even try to be holy ourselves and demonstrate that. But God, in many ways, is asking us to do something. He's always asking us to do something more difficult than we think we can bear. What a testimony is it to live in a time of confusion, in a time that says, if you don't like authority, or if you don't like a figure that's over you, throw them off, vote them out of office, leave the church, go to somewhere else, you know, you make your life what you want it to be. And we, as faithful Catholics, say, I'm not going to ignore the confusion. I'm not going to hide from it. I'm not even going to make excuses for it. But what I will do is live a faithful Catholic life and remain in obedience and in the church straight until my dying breath, God willing. That is a testament there that is beyond any argument, because they see in our lives that we're forced to deal with this seeming contradiction in our faith, and yet we stay true to it. It's a faithfulness that is very, very uncommon nowadays that we have an opportunity by God's grace to live out.
Just when you were saying that, you're thinking of all the saints you brought up, their last, most of them, you had something about their last words. And, you know, St. Paul talks about being joyful, being I finished the race. You got John Fisher talking, reading the Bible the last time, saying, this is the last time I get to read these words here. And the verse was very prophetic about what he's about to do. Thomas More making a joke on the scaffold. Teresa Jesus saying, I die a child of the church, daughter of the church. Mm-hmm. So yeah, even at the end, these guys, their mindsets were never, you know, upset or anger, or, you know, joyful, focused on Christ as the point.
Eternal. Yeah. Yeah. Their mind was on heaven. Their mind was on heaven. And their own death too, in many ways. You know, if you recognize that you're going to die and that you're going to have to hold an account to God in the end, God is not going to come to you and say, well, you know, on June, blah, 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 2017, Pope Francis said this, what did you think about it? You know, so that's not what our final account is. Well, am I a good father? Did I try to raise my children in the church? Did I do everything I could? Did I pray? Did I commune with God? When I committed a mortal sin, did I rush to confession as if my life depended on it? Because it does. You know, are those the things that I did? And all this other stuff is really just, it's when Satan is trying to get in and tear us from the faith and tear us from the church and strip us away from the vine, the life-giving vine. That's what this book is about. It's saying, don't listen to him. Stick with it. Stay in it. Faithful to the end, just like these saints were. And we'll be rewarded even if we don't really know what the perfect answer was in every circumstance by the end of our lives.
Kind of what you said, no excuses. These guys did not bring up excuses. They, like you said before, they blamed themselves for the situation in some sense. They didn't point to someone else. Oh, he did it. That Pope stinks, or that bishop did that, or woe is me. They
even went beyond that, and they took everything as an opportunity to be an imitation of Christ.
Yeah.
I mean, St. John of the Cross was so good at this. At the end of his life, you know, he was of ill health, and they were going to send him to a different monastery, and he chose one in which he knew that the person in charge of it hated him.
Yeah,
because he knew he'd be treated poorly. Which, I mean, my goodness, like, I wish I could get to that point. I'm not even close to there. You know, like sometimes I my slippers got moved, and I'm angry about the fact that my 2-year-old decided to go play with him somewhere. So, right, I got a lot to work on.
Yeah, but no one goes around saying, "I'm gonna go visit John. He hates my guts. I'm gonna go visit him today."
Yeah, exactly. So it's we can only do it with Christ, right? It doesn't make sense in human terms, but I'm, gosh, the Catholic Church is so. I used to be a Protestant. That's why I'm so thankful to be a part of the church. The theology of suffering within the church is so unique. I'm in Texas. I'm surrounded by a lot of Protestants. They're wonderful people, but there's this missing link where they for some reason they haven't quite gotten how the suffering is a participation in Christ's suffering, redemptive to ourselves, to the glory of the church, and that unlocks graces for ourselves and others. I mean, if you can see it that way, then all of a sudden the pain that's thrown upon us, the abuse that's thrown on us in those moments, even at the hands of the church, it reminds me of a quote from St. Padre Pio. I'm going to butcher it just a little bit, but it's something like, "Blessed is the hand of the church, even when she strikes us."
Yeah.
Because it's always going to be, if we're using that as a way to commune with Christ and offer it through his own redemptive sacrifice on the cross, and that's redounding to our benefit in the end. So yes, blessed. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Something like, sometimes she can be a painful mother or something like that. And you talked about, for bringing up being a convert. Sometimes it takes an immigrant to let the natives know what they have.
Well, it's, you know, I don't have any ill will towards Protestantism, right? It's in many ways it set the stage for me to be able to become a Catholic, but the profundity and the depth that is there, it does make suffering sweet. I never would have understood that before. You know, many Catholics, myself included, many times, we still just get in this like grit our teeth and bear it kind of mentality. Like God said to, you know, we got to suffer, hold up your cross. I'm going to drag it across the finish line. Even if I'm just barely clawing my way at the end. And well, yeah, Jesus said, carry your cross, but he never said that you got to be sort of angry and bitter about it and gritting your teeth to the end. He actually said, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. So there's this life-giving force to it. And then sitting with the saints for a while, it just infuses you with that holy hope, knowing that if they could make it through what they dealt with, which was loads worse than what I have to deal with, then heck, I should be fine.
Well, I mean, Teresa brought up that line, no sourpuss nuns. And she was all about joy in there. She's one, and she got persecuted from within.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. And it was bad. Some of them, too, you look at them, it's like all you want to do is start an order that's like, you know, rigorous in its commitment to penance and poverty. And then people in the church are like, how dare you? You know, it's like, oh, gosh, things don't change. Right. If you want to be particularly holy, your biggest enemies are going to be, somebody wearing a priest collar or a nun's veil.
Yep. Nothing changes. Just the time or the actors.
Yeah. You wish it weren't the case, but that's the way it's deigned to be.
Well, the book is at sophiapress.com. I'll have the link in the show notes persecuted from within, how the saints endured crisis in the church. Any final words besides buy the book? I was thinking about putting Beck in, please buy the book.
Yeah, well, I would say this was a labor of love more than anything else. It took about 2 years to work on, in part because it was just a lot of material to get through, and also just because we got day jobs, and I got a family to feed and everything like that. We're ghostwriters. We didn't go and write this out there so that we could parade ourselves around on TV and get interviews and things like that. This really was a labor of love for the church. So, whether you buy it, whether you wait until it shows up at a library, borrow it from a friend. I learned a lot from the saints in this book, and I hope y'all will too. So, please do try to grab a copy.
It'll probably bring more peace to your lives too when you figure out this is not the first time we've been through stuff like this. Yeah, it's different, but it's not the first time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The Lord's faithful to the end, as he was with every single one of his saints.
Amen to that. Well, I appreciate your time. And yes, underneath is the link to in the show notes for the book. Get it for a friend, get it for a seminary, get the message out there a little bit more, just so that, again, we can bring some cooler heads might prevail out there. I appreciate your time again. And thanks again for putting the book together. And he's being modest. He did it over a weekend.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I wish, right? My life would be a lot easier. But thank you for having me on.